It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the history of cyber warfare in the United States and talk about how Apple's disagreement with the FBI could affect cybersecurity going forward.
First, Congress is on recess this week, and the state's representatives are back home to meet with constituents and weigh in on next week's elections. Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat from La Crosse, discussed his top priorities today at a luncheon in Madison.
He joined us in our studios this morning for a look at the issues facing Congress and Western Wisconsin in particular. Ron Kind is a U.S. representative for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, which includes La Crosse and Eau Claire. Congressman Kind, welcome to Central Time.
That's my pleasure.
So, first of all, this talk in Madison, what are you focusing on today?
You know, I'm having a lot of discussions, a lot of meetings here in Madison, but it's about the direction our state needs to go and our nation overall. Obviously, this hasn't been democracy's finest hour, this presidential campaign, the rhetoric that we're hearing out there. I always thought presidential campaigns should be more aspirational, more what we can do together, what will it take to start uniting the state and the country again. We're not getting a whole lot of that, especially on the Republican side. And I think the people are wrestling with issues that they want to hear some answers to.
And what kind of issues are you hearing your constituents in the 3rd Congressional District bring up? What do they want to talk to you about?
Well, there's still growing concern about whether we're hitting our full potential economically with the type of good-paying jobs that we need back home here. They're worried about the affordability of higher education and student debt issues. I have 6 of the 11 state universities that I represent in my congressional districts, more undergrads in my congressional district than even here in Madison. So, you know, maintaining the accessibility, the affordability of higher ed is important to me and families throughout the state, and we need more focus on that. But, you know, I'd love to live in a state, too, that's making it easier for people to vote rather than erecting hurdles and passing voter suppression bills. I mean, for crying out loud, last primary election, we had a 92-year-old World War II vet, a survivor of Iwo Jima, that was denied his voting rights because he brought his Veterans Administration identification card with him, and it didn't meet the quote-unquote definition. Is that really where we're going as a state today?
And the primary election, of course, just around the corner. Wisconsin, everybody knows, a big player unusually this year. Do you think we are at play? We're a swing state in the general election come November.
Well, first, for the primary, I think it's kind of nice having the eyes of the nation on us. And hopefully this is an opportunity for some of those candidates to hit the reset button and start talking about serious issues and the challenges that we share as Americans rather than a discussion about wives and hands and every other nonsense things that we've been hearing out there. But, yeah, you know, traditionally Wisconsin's been a purple state. We usually have been a competitive battleground going into general elections. That may be true this year as well. So even though people think they just have to survive April 5th around here, we might have to wait until November before we get back to normal again.
You've been writing about campaign finance lately, opinion pieces and legislation, too.
Yeah.
What kind of reforms, what kind of changes are you hoping to see?
And I think some of the problems that ail our political system, both at home and at the national level right now, is structural. It's fundamental. It's, you know, redistricting. It's putting it in the hands of nonpartisan commissions to draw the political map and not allowing the politicians to choose their voters. I think that's leading to the intense polarization we have in the political system. And there's too much dark money, you know, these super PACs, these unaccounted for money grabs trying to influence the outcome of elections has to be changed. A good place to start is requiring complete transparency so that we know where the money is coming from, and then the people in Wisconsin can be the final referee in all this. But with the Citizens United case, there's just so much dark money that's going to lead to very bad results unless it gets fixed.
You've written a Campaign Transparency Act that I understand requires the candidates' campaigns themselves to disclose all donations. That doesn't touch the dark money, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. It's unfortunately a Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that established that right of so-called corporations to act as people and to spend unlimited amounts of sums and not disclose where it's coming from. You know, in the past, the Supreme Court said that we have the ability to regulate money in political campaigns to avoid corruption or even the appearance of corruption, but that was thrown out with the Citizens United case. It, again, is another example of why this open Supreme Court vacancy seat is so important and why the United States Senate needs to do their constitutional obligation and do their job this year, meet with the nominee, have hearings, and ultimately have a vote on them.
Talking to Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind about issues in the news and in Congress. Just saw a report, switching gears a little bit here, on broadband speed in Wisconsin. Yeah. The state as a whole, not looking too bad, except rural areas. And this is something you've been focusing on. What's the state of broadband in rural Wisconsin?
Well, you know, we've slipped a little bit as far as our national rankings, but we can't afford to do that. We can't afford to be doing this as a nation. You know, this is the information revolution that's taking place on a global scale. We can't afford to leave any community or any person behind when it comes to access to high-speed broadband connectivity. And that's especially challenging in the rural areas, that so-called last mile, where the build-out is more expensive than that. So we've been working with the commissioner of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, in order to free up some grant money that could go into investing in a lot of rural communities throughout Wisconsin and our country so there aren't any dark spots, any black spots that might occur. Let's face it, you know, we know, Rob, that if kids don't have access to high-speed internet connection, they're not going to be staying there. And it's one of the reasons we've got a brain drain taking place in Wisconsin. We need a statewide plan on how to close that gap and make sure we're leading the nation and not falling behind.
Apart from those FCC grants, are there things you can do legislatively that would help expand broadband access in rural America, not just Wisconsin?
You know, the one thing that shouldn't be done is blocking communities' choice of what type of broadband they want to build out, whether it's fiber optics. But I know there's been legislation pending here in Madison that would exclude that option, prohibit that option from taking place with local community leaders. And I think that would be unfortunate. But this, again, is consistent with the trend that we've seen in the state of taking away local decision-making power and resting it in the legislature or the governor's mansion here in Madison. And that, too, is going to take us to a bad place and ultimately lead to a lot of bad results.
Another story in your district, the ongoing scandal at the Tomah VA Medical Center, congressional hearings about that, changes of personnel there. Have things improved there? If for patients who actually go to the VA in Tomah, are they getting better care?
You know, I'm impressed with the improvement that has, the reforms that have been made there at Tomah. But I knew from the beginning that, you know, the whole issue of pain management at the Tomah VA was not just unique to that center in Tomah, but it's a challenge we face throughout the entire healthcare system. And that's why I'm glad that the President Obama, has made this a point of emphasis, the opiate issue and pain management and what we can do to best address that on a national scale, partnering with states and localities in our healthcare system, because this is also leading to increased meth and heroin use and that addiction epidemic that's sweeping Wisconsin right now. And as a former special prosecutor, this cannot be addressed on a criminal justice basis. This has to be a public health issue that we take this on. Early identification, early treatment, or we're going to be locking more people up, throwing the key away, and it just perpetuates this cycle of addiction. But Tomah is consistently ranked in the top 10% when it comes to metrics and quality measurements. But there were serious allegations that needed to be investigated, needed to be looked into, and then changes had to happen at Tomah, and I'm glad that it looks like they've turned the corner and are starting to head in the right direction.
On that opioid issue, this is something we've talked about a lot, including with Republican Assembly Member John Nygren. Is this an issue you think can get a lot of bipartisan cooperation?
I think so. The president certainly is leaning heavily into it, too. There's pending bipartisan legislation in Congress right now. I know I've worked closely with Senator Tammy Baldwin on this issue as well, and it's a little wonder because a lot of this is being driven by what's happening in our own local communities. And I've been having listening sessions around the state with law enforcement, healthcare, treatment centers, families that are impacted by addiction issues, too, to make sure that the federal legislation at least is heading in the right direction, that the partnership and support that needs to come home here in order to address this addiction and use is based on good research and good science and best evidence medicine, ultimately.
As we wrap up, of course, we've got elections in the short horizon, more coming up in November. Race for governor in 2 years.
Yeah.
And your name often gets thrown out there when Democrats are looking for a candidate. Any thought that you might consider that over the next 2 years?
Well, you never say never to something like that, and it's a little bit early and premature, but you know, I am disturbed, as a lot of people are, about the direction we're going as a state. You know, these whole voter suppression issues, the dismantling of the government watchdog entities that are supposed to be nonpartisan referees, keeping an eye on our public officials that has been eliminated now. The lack of support for higher education. reputation and the reputation we're developing as a state right now. But right now what's pending is this presidential primary season. And listen, I'm supportive of Secretary Clinton. I don't think there's anyone who's more experienced, more qualified, more ready to assume the responsibilities or the burdens of the highest office in the entire world, let alone our country, than Secretary Clinton right now. And her agenda to expand and strengthen the middle class is, I think, the direction we ought to go in. And her expertise when it comes to the security challenges we face, both abroad and here at home, is unsurpassed by any other candidate in this race. It's not even a close call from my perspective.
We'll leave it there for now. Congressman Kind, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Ron Kind, U.S. Representative for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, which includes La Crosse and Eau Claire. He joined us in our studios earlier today.
Coming up, we'll learn about the history of cyber war in the U.S. and how Apple's disagreement with the FBI could affect cybersecurity going forward.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about how being environmentally conscious might influence a person's decision to have children in the era of climate change.
First, we may think of cyber warfare as a brand new concept, but it turns out it's been on the minds of government officials since some of the very first computers.
In his new book, our next guest looks at the secret and often surprising history of our nation's cybersecurity strategies. Fred Kaplan joins us now. He's the author of the new book, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Fred, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks.
Well, we think of cyber war as something that's very new, but in fact it goes back to some of the earliest government computers. What can you tell us about the very early years of cybersecurity?
Right. It actually goes back to the dawn of the Internet itself. There was something called the ARPANET that was about to roll out. That was the precursor to the Internet, and there was one scientist named Willis Ware. He was the head of the computer science department at the RAND Corporation. He was on the scientific advisory board to the National Security Agency. And he wrote a paper. It was secret at the time. It's been declassified since. And he said, look, once you put information on a network, once you have online access from multiple unsecured locations, you are creating inherent vulnerabilities. You're not going to be able to keep secrets anymore. And people read the paper, they thought it was very interesting, and they basically ignored it. And, we are where we are today because of the fact that nobody took action, that whole systems and networks grew up over the subsequent decades that had no provisions for security whatsoever.
When did it first show up on the White House agenda?
Well, it's really one of the most peculiar stories I unearthed. In the first weekend of June 1983, Ronald Reagan was up at Camp David, and, he watched a lot of movies, and that Saturday night he watched War Games. You might remember War Games was the movie with Matthew Broderick mm-hmm. as a teenage whiz kid who unwittingly hacks into the main computer of the North American Air Defense Command, and thinking that he's playing some new game called Global Thermonuclear War, almost sets off World War III. So the following Wednesday, Reagan's back in the White House. There's a big meeting with his national security advisors. It's not about this, it's about something else. But at one point, he puts down his index cards and he says, has anybody seen this movie War Games? Nobody had it. It had just come out. He launches into this lengthy plot description. Everybody's kind of looking around, rolling their eyeballs, wondering what's going on here. And he finally turns to his top general, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says, General, could this something like this really happen? The general says, I'll look into it, Mr. President. Comes back a week later, says, Mr. President, the problem is much worse than you think. This leads to the first presidential directive on computer security, which reads a lot like government documents that you read today telling about how computer systems, which were then just fledgling, are vulnerable to electronic interference by foreign agents, criminals, terrorists. This led to the policies, to the tensions between privacy and security, to rivalries between the National Security Agency and other branches of government that have come down to us to this day, 33 years later.
And it's not a smooth trajectory where the issue surfaces and from then on the top government officials are fully invested in it. It's been sort of fits and starts, hasn't it?
It's fits and starts. I mean, it's like a lot of things in government. You know, a new administration comes to power. They kind of dismiss everything that the previous administration has done, and it takes them a while to realize that maybe they had something there. And you know, even in the 80s, it was still a little bit theoretical. We, the United States, were hacking into other countries' systems all over the place, especially the Soviet Union and China. It wasn't really until the 90s, the Clinton administration, that there were signs that other countries had figured out how to do this too. Again, especially Russia and China. And it was around 97, 98 that some major hackings into national security networks began to take place, and that our government started to get at least a little bit serious about doing something about it.
There's some remarkable stories in your book. You tell one about the NSA, certain officials there trying to drum up interest in this new topic, cybersecurity, and actually instigating a fake attack on government networks.
Right. Well, there was the director of the NSA in the late 90s was a three-star Air Force general named Ken Minahan, who'd been aware of this problem for a long time. Nobody was interested in it. So he got permission to conduct a war game where about 25 NSA red team people, sort of elite hackers, would hack into Defense Department networks. Now, it had to go through lawyers, and one condition was that they could use only commercially available equipment. The lawyers weren't going to let the NSA unleash its top secret spy gear on American networks, even in a game. But the long and short of it is that 2 weeks had been laid aside for this game, and within 4 days, they had hacked into everything. In some cases, they just left a little marker, like, you know, Kilroy was here. In some cases, they disrupted email, sent phony email, erased messages, changed plans. And the people looking at what was going on had no idea that anybody was even hacking into their system. They knew that something bizarre was happening, that they didn't trust their communications anymore. They didn't know what was going on. And even if they had known what was going on, at that time there were no protocols, procedures, bureaucracies in place to tell them what to do about it. And it was at that moment, it was a war game called Eligible Receiver, that they started to get a little bit serious. They started to put, for example, these little devices called intrusion detection systems on computers. And guess what? The first thing that began to happen, they began to detect intrusions. You can mark sort of 1988 as the time when things really started to step up and a real cyber offense, defense, arms race. But again, kept very secret. We haven't known about this until very, very recently, but within the most inner sanctums of top secret government, this has been going on now for nearly 20 years.
We're talking right now with Fred Kaplan, talking about his new book called Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. And right now, cybersecurity and national security, a big topic right now with the showdown between Apple and the FBI. How do you frame the flashpoints in that debate?
Right. Well, first, it has to be looked at in a certain context. There has been complicity between telecoms and intelligence communities going back nearly a century, dating back to the 1920s when a U.S. intelligence agency persuaded Western Union to give it access to all telegraphs coming in and out of the country. When telephones came along, AT&T allowed the FBI and the NSA to tap phones. In the internet age, it got to be a two-way street. If you're a software or hardware company and you're wanting to sell your wares to the U.S. government, especially the Defense Department, it has to be vetted. Now, who vets it for security? It's the NSA. They're the ones who know about this. And, for example, the first Microsoft Windows operating system that was sent to the NSA for vetting, the NSA found 1,500 points of vulnerability. And they helped Microsoft patch them. Well, not all of them, most of them. They left a few open so that they could hack into them when foreign governments bought these same systems. So this has been going on. And, you know, when the Snowden leaks happened, a lot of companies, you know, were outraged. But I sort of liken this to that scene in Casablanca where Captain Renault says that he's shocked that gambling's going on here while the croupier delivers his winnings for the night. So in that context, what's going on in Apple versus the FBI, it really has almost nothing to do with this particular phone that the FBI wanted to unlock. It really has to do with the FBI wanting to create a legal precedent to strengthen its authorities or to maintain its authorities in a new coming age of much stronger encryption versus Apple, which wanted to disrupt this arrangement and set it on a different path. That's what the case really is about.
And Fro, we've got about 30 seconds left here, but I'm guessing in looking at the history of cyber warfare, you've seen the future too. What should we expect for what the future of cyber warfare might look like?
Well, you know, the guy that I mentioned at the beginning, Willis Ware, one thing that he told some people in the early 80s, in fact, it was the screenwriters of War Games who wanted to know if their scenario was plausible. He said, the thing is that the only computer that's completely secure is a computer that no one can use. That's sort of the lesson that's going on here. There really isn't anything that can't be hacked into. And so what a lot of government officials are emphasizing now, I mean, they're still trying to make the locks better, but they're also emphasizing detection. You know, can you make sure you can detect when somebody intrudes very quickly, and resilience. Make sure that you can recover and repair the damage as quickly as possible.
Fred, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Fred Kaplan. His new book is called Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War.
Coming up, our guest tells us how she and other environmentally conscious people weigh the risks of having a baby during a time of climate change. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The planet's health outlook may not be so good in the next decade and the years to come, according to many climate studies. There are concerns about flooding and drought, higher temperatures, and more damaging storms, to name just a few of the risks.
Our next guest asked the question, if you're an environmentally conscious person who's worried about the future of the planet, how might you think about the future of your own children who'll be living on it? Should you even have kids in this context? Madeline Ostrander joins us now. She's a contributor to The Nation and a contributing editor at Yes Magazine. She recently wrote the article, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth? Madeline, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us what you were going through, what you were thinking when you decided to tackle this issue in this piece.
Well, it was a conversation that I felt like people were having in very quiet, almost whispered ways about how climate change might affect not just our own futures, but the future of any kids we might choose to have. And people would murmur things to me kind of quietly, like, when I read about all of this, these predictions and the science about climate change, I wonder, should I even have kids? And then they would make a decision one way or the other, but I would never hear back from them about, you know, why they had decided to have a baby or how they felt about what it means to be a parent at a time like this. And I felt like that was an important conversation and a difficult conversation, but one that people needed to have, because I think it makes it clear what the stakes are when we're talking about climate change.
I think this sort of thing has come up before the era of climate change. People have thought, oh, with the risk of, I don't know, nuclear war during the Cold War or some other bad things going on Earth, people might think, should I bring a kid into this world? Is there something you think that's different about climate change, about global warming in particular, that makes this such a urgent conversation for people?
I think there are those parallels. I do think this is a somewhat different conversation in the sense that, first of all, climate change is already actively happening right now. So the threat of nuclear warfare was a looming threat, and it was a threat of something that could happen. And, of course, warfare could always happen. I mean, the world has many conflicts going on. But climate change is something. It's this trend that is happening now and is getting worse. And as a society, scientists agree that we're not doing enough to respond rapidly enough to it. So the future looks increasingly more difficult. And I think that makes the threat much more potent and difficult to wrestle with.
And you write about the environment. You write about the impacts of global warming. And so presumably do people in your circles. Do you think you are particularly attuned to this? This is a particular worry for you because of that.
I think that I'm part of a segment of people for whom this is a particular worry. If you look at some studies done by the Yale Project on Climate Communication, they talk about how there are different percentages of the American public in terms of their views on climate change. And there's a substantial segment of the American public called the alarmed. That's how they've decided to categorize them. And those are people who both understand the science, see that climate change is happening, that it's real, but also see it as a real potent threat and understand the risks of it. And I guess I would say that because I am an environmental journalist and I write about these issues and I have regular conversations with climate scientists, I am part of that group. But it's certainly not a small or insubstantial group of people, I don't think.
It seems like there's a two-pronged concern here. One is, do I want to introduce a kid to this world where bad things are happening and worse things might happen? And we can get into that more. But part of it is the environmental impact of having children, especially in the United States, in and of itself. Can you talk a little bit about that concern, like the idea that we might be contributing to the problem simply by having children?
Yeah, that's a question that I've heard other people, I've heard environmentalists struggle with it. I've heard many kinds of people think about that question. It's a question that's been around since the 70s when Zero Population Growth, the organization, was founded and when Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb. I think that what I finally settled upon in my own thinking about this was that I don't think you can filter the entire problem of climate change through the choices of individual women and families, and that these are really deeply personal choices. I called up and spoke with the head of Population Connection, which is the new name of the organization formerly called Zero Population Growth, and that was their position as well, that these are really personal and private decisions, and that the question about population growth is something that can get handled through things like better access to contraception and healthcare for women. And that's how they're approaching that question. I think, you know, there are other people who think about the sort of environmental cost of having a baby, and that's a big factor for them. I guess for me, it's more potent to think about what kind of future any children born now will have, and how am I a part of making that future better and more sustainable.
We're talking to Madeline Ostrander. She wrote a piece in The Nation magazine titled, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth? And Madeline, you mentioned earlier you knew a lot of people who were murmuring this conversation. You also write about an organization that's getting people together to talk about these issues. Can you tell us some about that?
Yeah, I met with the founders of this organization and I attended a couple of their events as part of writing this story. It's a brand new organization founded a few months ago called Conceivable Future, and it's founded by a woman named Megan Coleman and another woman named Josephine Ferrarelli, and they have a website. They've been hosting small gatherings around the country in places like Los Angeles and Chicago and Providence, Rhode Island, and here in Seattle, Washington, where people get together, and a lot of the group will be people of childbearing age, but sometimes, you know, it'll be a pretty diverse group in terms of ages and concerns and interests. And they'll talk about this very question of what's happening in terms of climate change and how does that affect our decisions about family and about some people show up who have children and they talk about how does this affect their parenting. And it's an attempt to open up this conversation that's been quite difficult to have otherwise because it's, you know, it's awkward. I mean, parenting and childbearing, those are really personal decisions, and it's sort of awkward to bring them up with someone and then also bring up this big global scary question about global warming.
I wanted to ask, yeah, this is, as you say, probably the most deeply personal sort of decision a person can make, whether or not to have kids and, of course, how to then raise kids, and then this global issue of climate change together. Are these conversations difficult in this setting?
They're not difficult in that particular setting. The couple of events that I went to, I felt like people were very respectful. People you know, maybe they were a little bit cautious about sharing their feelings, but once the conversation got started, I think it's one of those things like anytime you have a conversation that's a bit taboo or a subject where people feel like they have strong feelings about it, but they're uncomfortable talking about those feelings, and you open that conversation up, it's like, you know, opening a floodgate or something. I mean, people welcome the opportunity to have that conversation, I think, which was part of what I was trying to do also in the essay that I wrote, was to give people permission to have this discussion.
You write that the decision to have a child is really centered around hope and love. And on the other hand, this question of climate change is all in a lot of ways about fear of the future. How do the people you talk to try to navigate between those two extremes?
It's difficult. The event that I went to in Seattle, for instance, there were people who were really uncertain about whether they should have children for those reasons because they were afraid of what the future looked like. There was someone who was pregnant and who had a child, and she said that she and her husband had talked very deliberately with their children about, or were planning to talk to them about what the future might look like, and thinking actively about how do you prepare people for a different kind of world. And those are hard things to think about as well, because although we have many predictions for what climate change might look like, of course, what the future looks like depends a lot on global emissions and what we do as a society to deal with the problem. And so it's difficult to know exactly what shape that will take. But that is how I think some people are thinking about it. How do I prepare my kids for this kind of future?
Did you see the prospect of parenting maybe motivating people to take action, motivating some sort of environmental activism on their part?
Yeah, I think I do see and know people for whom parenting becomes a very powerful and potent way to engage in the world and think about their impacts on the planet and to think more tangibly about the decisions we're making now and how those affect the future.
We're talking to Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributor to The Nation magazine and Yes magazine. She recently wrote the article, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth?
And we want to hear what you have to say. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Have you ever considered not having children because of the dangers posed by climate change? Does the state of the planet make you consider the future of your loved ones? Call us at 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation with Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributor to The Nation and a contributing editor at Yes Magazine. She recently wrote the article, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth?
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you've thought about yourself, maybe talked about with your spouse, your partner, with your friends? Has the state of the planet, the environment, influenced the way you and your family thought about having kids? What decision did you ultimately make, or are you still deciding? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Madeline, you wrote this in part because you had gone through this thought process, this decision yourself. Can you talk us through your own story?
Over the years, as I said, people had this sort of conversation in passing with me, and it made it very difficult in a lot of ways. I once had lunch with a literary agent, and I was talking to her about my writing on climate change, and she said, "Does it make you not want to have kids?" And it was such a strange, in a way, thing to come out of the conversation, and yet it's a thought that I think logically pops up for people when they think about how uncertain the future is. I would have friends whisper this to me, and then, you know, the conversation was so awkward that it wouldn't continue. And then as I was wrestling with my own decisions about it, I think, you know, it's a normal human desire to want to have a family. And I felt that desire growing in my emotions. And I felt like I wanted to participate in that process, and you know, in I think it's a thing that expands our humanity, and I think there are a lot of uncertainties in the world, but I had to come to my own decisions about it, so Yeah, that's what I talked about in the piece.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Pete is on the line in Eau Claire. Pete, hi.
Hey, my kids are growing already. I'm 57, so obviously the question has been answered for me. But I think there was something back in around 1050 called the little climatic optimum, where the planet warmed up, ice caps melted, coastal regions of Europe flooded, the Vikings were doing fine in Newfoundland and Iceland and Greenland. They kept on having kids, and here we are today. I think, don't overthink it too much, but I think it's okay to probably have kids and keep the species moving forward.
Pete, thanks for the call. So Pete's saying we've been through climate variations, significant climate changes in the past. For that matter, we've been through great plagues and things like that. People kept having kids, and here Pete says we are. Madeline, what do you think?
Well, I do think this is different. The science says that what we're heading for in terms of the climatic conditions are unprecedented in human history and experience. So I think this is a pretty different kind of scenario we're talking about. Last week, many people probably saw that James Hansen had a provocative paper out with some other colleagues about the possibility that we could see very extreme climate change happening in the period of a few decades. And there was some controversy about that paper. Scientists had some disagreement about it. It talked about the potential for big changes in the coastal flooding, wiping out coastal cities within a much shorter period of time than we had previously imagined. And I think for me, while there's always going to be some uncertainty in how that science plays out and how climate change actually gets expressed on the planet, I think, the basic message is we're going to have to be dealing with some very difficult things that are unprecedented in most of our experiences, and that is scary, and I think it should give all of us pause. And I don't think it should make us hopeless, but I think it raises the stakes when you think about it that way. It makes you understand why we need to take this issue seriously and do something about it now in the present.
Pete, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jill on the line in Madison. Jill, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've been listening in, and thank you very much. This has been a topic that I've been kind of agonizing over for about 10 years. I'm an environmental science major, and I know, the facts. And to imagine what a kid would have to live through, I'm about 35, and thinking about what the world may be like in 2050 or later for them is kind of, worrisome. But in the end, I came to realize that all life is precious and that any child would relish any amount of time that they were given. No matter what happened. So that's where I'm at now, and I go a little bit back and forth, but I think that it would be, I would regret it if I didn't.
Jill, thanks for the call. And Madeline, is that something that you see people arriving at after they wrestle with this for months or, in Jill's case, years?
People arrive at all kinds of different conclusions. Some people decide that they want to devote their lives to people who are very, very serious about these issues about climate change, about the environment. Sometimes they decide that they would rather take their energy and devote it to solving those problems and crises rather than siphoning off some of that energy into the process of raising the family. Other people feel like they want to live in hope, and just as your caller just said, that they want to, that's how they want to live their lives. And so that's the decision that they arrive at. So I think there's a range of ways to respond to this question.
Jill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Madeline Ostrander about her piece in The Nation titled, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth? Along the lines of what you're just saying, Madeline, Jerry on Facebook writes, my husband and I decided back in 1990 not to have kids because of the environmental impact, along with my passion for teaching. So, Jerry, you think about the environmental impact and what she can do with her energy, I think, in some ways, without kids. So that's another of the variety of responses you were talking about. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's close to what I've heard from a lot of people. There are other people who have talked about their decision to adopt or to otherwise be involved in kind of, I don't know if alternative parenting is the right word, but I know people who take a lot of responsibility, say, for a godchild, or they're involved in raising parents in some other kind of, raising children in some other kind of role. And some of those people have arrived at those decisions because they're concerned about the impact of having their own child. So sometimes people go that direction as well.
Time for another brief call, I think, from Deborah in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
I think there's way too many people on this planet, and the planet is our source of life. And if people really, really do cherish life, they need to take a look at a good hard look at what's going on. Because we're at the top of the food chain, and that's a big responsibility. And I think what we're really doing is ruining the planet.
Deborah, thanks for the call. So that's going back to that argument from the 70s you mentioned, Madeline. There's just too many of us to be good for the environment. And that's have you seen that as part of the thought process in, you know, the 2010s and not so much the 1970s, that we just have too many people and that's one reason not to make more of them?
I do hear people with that concern. I will be honest and say that I seem to hear it from, for instance, in these conceivable future gatherings that I attended, I heard it less from younger people, so say from millennials, than hearing it from the older generation who grew up with these concerns in the 70s or who, you know, came of age while they were being talked about. But it is a concern people have out there that there are too many children, and people arrive at different conclusions based on that. Some people have fewer children than they might otherwise have. Some people feel like they don't want to have any children. You know, Bill McKibben wrote the book Maybe One a number of years ago, where he talked about how maybe we have small families. So there's different ways to think about it, and it's a very personal decision, as I said before.
We'll leave it there. Madeline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributor to The Nation magazine and a contributing editor at Yes magazine. In The Nation, she recently wrote the piece, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth? We have a link, by the way, to that piece at the Central Time Facebook page, and still time for you to share your thoughts over there.